This journey began in a most unusual way. I'm going to talk a little bit about my particular journey, but I'm also going to try to put it in the context of the journey that many contemporary Western Jews are undergoing now. Mine is not a very unique journey. I know that there are people in this very building who have made journeys like I have, who've made it in much greater depth than I have, who've gained much more knowledge than I've got, and I want to thank them for encouraging me in the writing of this book and in the reading of the book. I am a classic case of arrested development. I was going to say when I got up here that if I'd had met this many people at my bar mitzvah, I really would have been happy. But of course, I wasn't bar mitzvah until I was 42 years old. I've been an adult bar mitzvah in a synagogue outside Chicago because I was raised in a classically reformed Jewish family on the south side of Chicago. We celebrated Christmas. We might light a menorah occasionally, but we would mostly just do that to bet on which candle lasted the longest. We did some sort of labor Zionist seders every now and then at Hexamut and Drucka. But we were raised with a kind of classically German assimilated Reform Judaism. And I have a sibling in the audience. I don't want to single her out, but I think it's worth noting from a sociological perspective that I'm the youngest of six children. I'm the only one married to a Jew, and I'm the black sheep of the family. Nobody's comfortable with my wife. You know, it's a big issue that she keeps kosher. So we're still, you know, this is the kind of the context that I came from. I hear the crab cakes are very good at dinner tonight, by the way. But to put that in context, then my journey into other traditions began very late. But at the time that it began, it didn't strike me as shocking at all. It should have, because by the time I started investigating Buddhism, I had already married an observant Jewish woman who had two children from a previous marriage, and who said to me, look, in marrying me, you're committing to a serious Jewish life. You've got to get educated Jewishly. You have to help me raise these children in a Jewish home. You have to help me keep the kosher kitchen. You have to help the kid with their homework. And if you're going to do that, you better learn enough Hebrew to help them leave through first grade. Otherwise, you're not a bunch of Jews. So I did that. I dutifully did those things. I did an adult education program. My wife was a cantor at a Reform synagogue in Denver, Colorado. That's where we met and married. And when we moved back to Chicago, where we're both from, about 10 years ago, she retired from the cantor, and we joined the conservative, really traditional, but formerly conservative school outside of Chicago. And it was at a point where I really felt proud of myself for finally being an honorable Jew. Because I knew the order of the holidays. I knew the Hebrew alphabet. I was there. So we walk into the conservative school, and I can't understand a thing that's going on. The entire service is conducted in Hebrew. The Bima is set up once like this. I said, why is this guy in the middle facing? Where's he facing? I'm over here. In other words, my knowledge was very elemental, very rudimentary, and I didn't even know it. But the problem was I took this personally, and I said, if this is Judaism, it's not speaking to me. So in that respect, I was kind of, I think, the classic American Jew. I think that Canadians are much more polite and much more together. I had a guy today that seemed more was offering to share a bathroom with me. So polite was inappropriate, you know. But I feel like I'm in Canada, I have to be polite. Thank you. But at least in the American sense, we sort of feel like if it doesn't work, let's go shopping for something else, right? The world is available. We live in an uncle kitchen. There's all sorts of spiritual journeys to be had. Let's go explore. And I really wanted to learn to meditate. I had felt for a long time that was something that could at least center me spiritually so that everything else could make sense. But I couldn't find, not that I tried as hard as I could, but I couldn't find a teacher of Jewish meditation. And actually, a Jewish woman who was a therapist, actually the parent of a kid who went with ours to a Jewish day school, said, you know, I know a Zen center. Maybe you ought to try that. They'll teach you how to meditate. So I went to a Zen center nearby Evanston, Illinois, and 2 years later, after an intense immersion into Zen Buddhism, I was way ordained as a Zen Buddhist. Didn't strike me as shocking at all, but of course my wife was beside herself. To her, this was akin semi-track mark is it happening yet? I think it's happening because my wife is mad at me. I don't think it's, you know, my, there's someone talking to me. I think it's my kids, you know. I think it's my wife. But it kept happening. And so I spoke to the vendor. She said, I can't come back. She said, I understand. This happens a lot. And in fact, it does. In fact, a lot of Jews who go deeply exploring other traditions come back. And they come back renewed, refreshed, invigorated, inspired to find what they now know exists in Judaism, or now sense exists in Judaism. I think Jews for Judaism is very good at that work. And I think Rabbi Skobak and his wife Kaji, who taught a meditation class at my house and did a wonderful job, I think they deeply recognize that Jews can be helped to learn. I certainly learned it. And I said to Rabbi Katz in the book, you know, it may not be such a good thing in the eyes of many Jews that I did this, but I think it may be a better journey. To which he replied in the book, well, you know, an amnesiac might be cured by a blow to the head, but that doesn't mean you're going to start prescribing blows to the head for amnesiacs, does it? But that would be a better way. I want to read to you one thing from the book, which is the description of my failed PR move, which was to take my wife to the vet center and show her how normal it really was. Now, really, what goes on there is not something that's threatening. We're not shaving our heads in vain, tampering the airport. You know, we're not collecting Django Street on it. We're people who are trying to deepen ourselves spiritually. And I had a teacher who I thought was wonderful at doing that. And so I said, you know what? I said to my teacher, can I bring my wife and my teacher to the center? What's the teacher, the Zen priest at the Zen Center, also happens to be a Jungian therapist. I thought, what better? You know, we can get some psychoanalysts and analysts into the bargain. We can not only deepen ourselves, but my wife will see that he's crazy. So this is what happens. I take my wife to the Zen Center. After a little instruction and discussion, we begin sitting in meditation together, that my wife wants to come. The priest, dressed in clothes, conservative clothes that say, hi, I'm a Jungian therapist, greets my wife and shows her the meditation hall, the kitchen, the small library, and the outdoor garden. She explains to people who come to the Zen Center are people from diverse religious backgrounds and that many of these people are still active in those religions. She even has a student who for more than 2 decades was a Carmelite nun. My wife looks around and she says, why are there statues? Well, my meditation teacher says the statues of the Buddha are there as a reminder of the essence of what we call Buddha nature. It represents a certain kind of centered, aware, solid presence that we each have and can cultivate within ourselves. In my religion, my wife says passively, we call that idol worship. It's strictly forbidden. Well, my teacher begins, oh, my wife interrupts, and by the way, it's my husband's religion too. And it's the religion we're raising our children in, just so there's no confusion. I understand, the meditation teacher says. I begin staring intently at my shoes. So, why do you want to get my husband to practice this entirely different religion? My wife asks, what's integrated? Kind of like saving souls? He came to be seeking instruction in meditation, the teacher says evenly. I can see that it's something that's very important to him and that might benefit him. And when someone seeks instruction for me, I first try to discern whether they're serious about it. I can see that he is. And it's not in my nature or my job description, if you choose to look at it that way, to refuse people instruction in what I've been trained to teach them. I hear there's a lot of bowing in Buddhism, my wife says. Do you bow? Yes, there is bowing, my teacher says. What do you bow to? It depends on what part of the service we're in. Oh, my wife interrupts. So it's not just meditating, it's a regular religion with services and everything. Well, my teacher says, it's true that Buddhism is a religion. And so what do you bow to again? We may bow across the meditation hall to each other after sitting, or we may bow to the Buddha statue at the head of the hall. If that's not idol worship, I don't know what is, my wife fairly submits. But the statue does not represent a deity. There's no worship per se in Buddhism. You can call it whatever you want, my wife says. We bow to the statue of the Buddha because we're recognizing and honoring Buddha nature. I think I've seen enough, my wife says. Come on, let's go. My teacher regards my wife evenly for a second. My wife is breathing hard, her nostrils are dilated. She's seething with revulsion and anger. The teacher tries once more. This is something he may pursue, though, the teacher says. It may be important for him. No, I don't think so. You get the idea. I actually rising at a deep level that I was Jewish. And as a result of my wife's insistence that what I was doing was fundamentally untrue, not just to her, but to all units of Jewish identity, the self, the family, the marriage, the community, I felt totally clear that I would not be going back to this end. As a result of that, I did, as I said, an adult bar mitzvah. I began to learn Hebrew. I spent 10 days at the conservative yeshiva in Jerusalem. I tried to earn a master's degree in studies. I'm trying in small steps to get literate. But the best thing that happened in all this process was that my wife went to some Orthodox rabbis that run a Torah learning center very near my house. One of them is South African, and one of them is American. The American gentleman was the one that really taught our children and done wonderful work with our family. And she went to him and said, Rabbi Karsh, you've got to help me stop him. You've got to help me stop my husband. He said, what is he doing? She said, he's turning into a Buddhist. He's going to a Zen center learning how to meditate. Rabbi Karsh, an Orthodox rabbi, said, and what do you want to help with again? She said, this is wrong. You have to help me stop him. She said, Rabbi Karsh, to her astonishment, said, no, you don't understand. He's engaged in the spiritual search. Let him go. This is wonderful, actually. Because he's going to learn a great deal and he's going to come back. Sometimes, you know, a tugboat takes a while to turn around. You know, the big ship, if they're deep in the water, it'll take a while. But he'll come back. You mustn't interrupt this. If you do, spiritually, you don't know what's going to happen. So let him go. That was one thing that happened. The other that happened with the South African rabbi, Zev Kahn, was that he said, you know, I know a rabbi from South Africa, maybe you've heard of him, Rabbi Peter Pastor. I said, no. And he said, you know, he wanted to correspond with the Jews on Buddhism. He hears that this is a real phenomenon, but he doesn't know anything. He wants to find out why this is happening. Could you maybe, I'll give you his email address that you write him and tell him some of the obstacles for you to being an observant Jew. I said, sure. That began a correspondence that was very intense and lasted over a year, and the result of that correspondence is a book. Rabbi Katz, in a way that only a master can do, made clear his deep disdain for what I did and his deep compassion for why I did it. And he taught me brilliantly without ever judging me. Or if he did judge me, it didn't occur in a way that I felt was going to obstruct my growth as a Jew. I've learned a lot, and I've learned, among other things, that the Talmud says that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred between Jews. One thing that I feel is a great obstacle to Jewish learning is sectarian strife between the various denominations of Judaism. I think the knowledge is there for all Jews to delve into. I think the knowledge and the dogma in contravention to what most people believe, rather than being an obstacle to spiritual growth, is actually the doorway to spiritual growth. Learning the choreography must, however, be accompanied by hearing the music. The Shema is the central prayer, and it's about hearing. And the brain, our brain, if I've learned anything in Buddhism, is that the brain makes a great deal of noise. The brain is a filter. We can't possibly hear or take in or absorb all the stimuli that are coming at us, because if we did, we drop dead in an instant. And that's true of the spiritual realm, as well as of many other realms. Meditation helps open the filter to the spiritual realm. It helps open the filter to prayer, to understand what prayer really is. Excuse me for a moment. And that's why I think for Jews to learn to meditate, which I think is the bedrock experience that underlies prayer, is not a bad thing. It's not something all Jews need to do. And let me hasten to say that I don't think my experience gives me the right to tell anybody what to do. I can only share with you my experience and hope that you'll learn from it. My experience has been that meditation is at its root a Jewish experience. There are stories of meditation all through the Torah, all through the Tanakh. There is a wonderful tradition of Jewish meditation, and it is nothing but preparation for prayer. If that is the worst thing likely experiencing that inaccessibility despite living an active Jewish life, pursuing more Jewish education, raising Jewish children. The real question is exactly what is it about Judaism that is sending Jews in other directions? Although Buddhism is a venerable tradition, you have said that best it can be seen as preparation for a life of Torah. My response to this is ironic but truthful. In my experience, Buddhism does a better job of preparing one to live a Jewish life than does Judaism. I'll quote you from Rabbi Tass's response. Dear David, that is exile. That is how far the Western Jew has become estranged from the real and proper engagement of his mind and heart. A core issue here is lack of genuine Jewish education, and far worse, non-authentic Jewish education to the point where what is known of Judaism could hardly be more wrong. The modern Jew who is the victim of such education may come to reject the verse of Judaism that he knows, not surprisingly given his distorted picture, in favor of something that appears as beautiful, not beginning to realize that what he is feeling is no more than a fragment of the real Judaism he's not the best to discover. Rabbi Tass and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on all things, doesn't have to agree. And I think that's where I'm going to end my time. So before I entirely end it, I just want to say that I hope that each of you who want to explore spiritually and who are Jewish will consider doing so in a Jewish context, because I've learned the hard way that though there are many ways up a mountain, there are also many Jewish ways up that particular mountain, and that they all deserve exploration and are crying out to be explored. And we don't have to take this any detour. Certainly there are those who will and do, and they're not to be judged. But there are riches waiting for all of us, crying to us not only from the book, but from the experiences and the teachers that are in our midst, amongst whom I count Rabbi Tass gratefully. Thank you very much. Just a request, if anyone here has a flash camera, not to use it until later on tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Detachment or forgetting about God. Because for the mother to understand that. Analogy. The two part mental head. In other words, you do the Because of all this.
Tolbert says that the lower self exists like a person by the street, and then it's like a guest at the door. The beggar at the door, then it's like a guest. And then if you're lucky, you remain a guest. Can I put it one more way? My great teacher in Jerusalem once said this: what's the right way to rob a bank? Walking with a motorcycle helmet and a cash is not going to be fun. The way to rob a bank is you make an appointment with the manager, you walk into his office, knock on the door, and you put a sock in his mouth. You put him in his closet, lock the closet, keep the seat, and you're on the back. That's the sensible way. That's the sensible way to run the back. That's how we have been hijacked by our lower self. Yet we think of it in the first place. That's part of the human, behind the human condition. Now, let's take one more. Are we together? One more step. What was the human response to this problem? What was the human response to being locked into the body and to be hijacked and taken over and imprisoned in a body? It seems to me, and I'm sure you may correct me, it seems to me that the universal human response has been that the body needs to be controlled. The body's a problem, it needs to be beaten down a little bit. And to the best of my self-knowledge, every spiritual path from that day on has been a pathway of celibacy, asceticism, beating down on the body and bringing it under control. Think about it from a Christianity perspective. Christianity is also just when it comes to intimacy and functions of the body. In Christianity, do you want to translate and become a monk or a nun? Muslims. In Islam, you may not own alcohol or drink. Own alcohol. I know because when I went to Israel for the first year, just before Pesach, I had some very expensive whiskey. So I don't want to pour out the whiskey, so I went down to the local bar. And I found an Arab on the street, and I asked him if he'd be kind enough to buy my whiskey. I knew what's going to drink it. I told him, buy the whiskey, I'll come back and get some, and I'll buy it back. He said, enough to buy the whiskey, he's not allowed out of the whiskey. I had to go down to a Christian workshop and they're trying to convert me to Christianity. I was born with you. You know that alcohol, which represents the perfect representation of tension between bringing the mind down into the body or use sensitivity to elevate and expand consciousness, is a massive problem in the world around us. A massive problem. I don't think there's a Western country in which there's not a legal age of drinking, but or buying alcohol. If you listen to your baby, such a thing, a baby's 8 days old. That's why I know. That's why it says, in Buddhism, as David has told me, there's a path of marriage. But even those who marry, there's a path called a household of spouse. But even then, there's a path of celibacy and a frequent retreat into asceticism and celibacy. Isn't it a good picture that the engagement of the body is negative? Huh? If you could get to that level without it, you'd be hungry. Wherever you look. In India, there was a very enlightened man called Krishnamurti, you might know about him. A very, very enlightened teacher. He came to England, not alive anymore. He was a very enlightened teacher, and he taught that marriage is evil. But, in other words, the problem was that the body has now taken over, and to free the soul, the response is you beat it down. And Abraham came on the scene and he said, the body's not the problem. brotherly citizen is an example of spiritual practice. But that's the Jewish function. Now that wine, the God of Israel says that wine is an avenue to the secret world because wine is that single physical substance that obeys the rules of the spiritual. And that's why Genesis, we take wine at every junction between spiritual and physical. But before getting married, when your physical body will engage in a relationship that we want to reach spiritual sanctity, pick up a wine and talk. Great minister of religion, we take him about into the body and giving it the ability to transcend it, every cup of wine. Shabbat in the week transcends into the elevation of Shabbat, we take a cup of wine. In every moment of connection with God, Saturday night, is a pinnacle of the Spirit that he comes down into the week to elevate the week for our higher level of ministry. We take a cup of wine. The Roman Bible says wine is that substance, we use it, because it's uniquely that substance which gives you access to the spiritual world. All other physical things get worse with time. All physical things, spiritual things like wisdom, get better with time. Physical things always get worse with time. Wine is that physical substance which gets better with time. It's an avenue of access to the spiritual world. The Holy Spirit, wherever you look, is a remarkable attempt to engage the body and reunite it in an elevated fashion with the soul. So whether I'll run, but you can go on a lot about this. Maybe I will. I'll speak with your apple matter to a proper question. What activity am I talking about? I've been talking about one subject tonight, and it's called mitzvah. Mitzvah. You know what a mitzvah is? A mitzvah is a physical action that expresses sanctity. The word mitzvah, you know what it really means? It does not mean commandment. If you know any Hebrew, you know that the right word for commandment is tzivui. The word mitzvah is something else. It contains the connotation of commandment, so it has another overlay. The word mitzvah in Hebrew means to commit. The tzatzahada means one body. Sevet means a crew, people who operate together. Mitzvah means an action that the animal body does that brings in the divine soul into that action. You know the Torah said in the beginning, Eile Tzorah Tzishumayim Vare, think about us, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth in their being created. Listen carefully. Heaven and earth, this dichotomous construction, in their being created, the word Yibaran spells the same letters as Abraham. Abraham. He's the one who brought together, this is just happy messages, and the number of Abraham is 1248. That number of positive commandments in the Torah. He's the one who brings in his sanctity and his body an expression of the divine. And that, of course, very few understand what the circumstances is, understand that that's exactly the message. There are many places you see this on. I'll just give you two more examples if I may. One, the Torah says in Morrison, the Torah says that anybody who learns Torah does not practice mitzvot in the world, that Torah is not Torah. Why not? If I engage that mystical worship and I understand it all, and I fail to act in accordance with it, I don't look at it. Why does not Torah is still wisdom? Honestly, that Jewish Torah is that which is content not responding to an interaction. One more example. The Talmud says that if a person grows up to be a person who knows Torah but is not fulfilled in the world, does not practice the 20 standard feet, doesn't live it in his body, friends have been ready to give them up to the commissioner was arguing with his friend Antonius, the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, who was very great French merchant. He is the great merchant man. On one occasion, Antonius said to him, "This was a step that comes from a Roman step, from that perspective, right?" He said to him, "I will show you that when you die, you can accept yourself from punishment." Because when you die, dying means separation of soul and body. That's the definition in Torah of death. That doesn't mean that the soul is dead, the soul is eternal. Dying means that the two are separated one from the other. So when the two are separated in death, you'll be able to accept yourself for punishment. Because when God comes to punish the body will say, "Well, you're not from me, I'm just another slave." If it hadn't been for the elevating power of the soul, I never would have sinned. Then when God tries to punish the soul will say, "Well, you don't kill me, I'm floating there like a bird." If it hadn't been for the wickedness of the body, I never would have sinned. That's right. The rabbi said, "I'll answer you as following. Listen to this beautiful illustration." He said, "A man once was a king who had an orchard. It had beautiful ripe fruit, ripe